The students then went back to the poem and talked intensely about why this lad had said that. What happened there is an example of what has come to be called oracy. I've always understood it to mean talk, with the added element of it taking place within education. But I'll clear that up in just a moment with my guest. She is Amy Gaunt, a former primary school teacher who now works at the oracy education charity Voice 21. Hello, Amy.
Hello.
Let's begin with the word itself. How do you define that word, oracy?
So at Voice 21, we define oracy as articulating ideas, developing understanding and engaging with others through speaking, listening and communication. In practice, in the classroom, that means that we are creating opportunities for children to learn to talk, but also to learn through talk. So learning through talk is basically what you described there in that episode of teaching that you described. So creating opportunities for children to develop their knowledge, their understanding through talk, but making sure that we're explicitly teaching them the oracy skills they need to do that really effectively.
And when was the word coined? Because it's fairly new, isn't it?
Yes, it's what we call a neologism, which essentially means that it's a made-up word. And it was made up by someone called Andrew Wilkinson, who was an academic and an education researcher in 1965, because he wanted to raise the profile of spoken language and listening by creating this sort of equivalence with literacy and numeracy.
And within schools, we have to say it's within education. I mean, we're all walking around talking, but we're not really doing oracy, are we?
Yes, exactly. It's about how we develop children's speaking, listening and communication skills in school, just like we develop their literacy skills and their numeracy skills.
So do you think that you can teach oracy?
Yes, I do.
So how? All right, well, let's explore it. How?
So it's both kind of how we teach, but also what we teach. So if we're thinking about that idea of learning to talk, so what we teach, I think we can teach oracy skills. You know, we don't innately know how to give a good presentation. We don't innately know how to contribute really effectively to a discussion. So I think you can teach those things in school.
Right, we'll come back to some of that in a minute, but we ought to say first, one of the reasons we're talking about this now is because it's been mentioned by people in government, hasn't it? So can you remind us of what's been said or written about oracy in some of the recent government pronouncements?
Yeah, so last year there was what was called a curriculum and assessment review, which essentially was a group of people taking a step back and looking at the curriculum and the assessment system and working out how effectively it's preparing children and young people for life. And one of the aspects of education that they looked at as part of that was how well the curriculum is developing children's speaking, listening and communication skills. And when the final report came out last year, essentially it said oracy is really, really important, and we need to do more to develop it in schools. Schools need more guidance and support to develop children's oracy skills.
Just take me to a classroom. As a teacher, they have in front of them the idea that today is oracy, or this session just after lunch is going to be oracy. What might that teacher be doing? What were you doing when you were teaching oracy?
So I don't know that it would have been a specific session that I said to students, right, this is oracy. A lot of it was about all of the teaching that we were doing. So it might have been, for example, in the primary classroom, we do a lot of getting children to turn and talk to their partner and discuss something. And then instead of sort of saying to children, you know, turn and talk to your partner and then kind of hoping for the best, actually making sure that we're teaching children how to do that really effectively. So, you know, making sure that you're facing your partner, that you're listening to them, that you're responding to what they're saying rather than just kind of waiting to give your response and say what you think about something.
Teaching people to listen, it's quite difficult. It's a thing to teach, isn't it? Because, you know, you might be bursting. Let's say we were talking about the water I've got in front of the table and you want to tell your story and I want to tell my story. I want to dive in. So how do you say to a young child, let's say 7 or 8, or for that matter, like the teenagers that I was working with, hold your horses, listen. How would you do it?
I think it's about your expectations that you set in the classroom. So you might be that you're getting children to talk to a partner, and then you might say, can you tell me what your partner said instead of just what you thought? So you're building in that expectation. They've had to listen, and then they're having to summarize what someone else has said and report that back to you. So there's lots of small kind of tweaks that you can make to everyday classroom practice to really sort of center listening.
Have you got some other examples from the classroom?
Yes, we'd also think about obviously in different subjects. So it might be that in maths you're asking children to work together to solve a problem, but you're also making sure that you're teaching them the oracy skills they need to do that really effectively. So it could be how to justify answers, how to ask someone for an example to explain their point. And then we also thought about what Douglas Barnes, who's an academic, termed presentational talks. So opportunities for children to speak to different audiences for different purposes. So that might have been presenting the findings of a science experiment to the class, or performing a poem or a story to an audience of parents or younger children. And we thought about it not just in the classroom as well, so we thought about it beyond the classroom as well. So we thought about building oracy into the wider life of the school. So we flipped the format of assemblies. So instead of having children sort of sitting in rows listening to the head teacher at the front, getting children sitting in circles discussing big kind of questions and topics together, and then some children standing up and presenting their thinking to the rest of the school as well.
And then what about something that I've heard people getting agitated about, which is extending the way in which children speak? I was in a situation just this week, and somebody told me that children are coming into schools, the way she expressed it was, with hardly any language, hardly any stories, hardly any ability to narrativize, in other words, to tell a story about their experience. And she felt that this was newish, but genuinely, if she said, "What did you do over the weekend?" to a 4 or 5 year old, there was nothing forthcoming. How do you do that? How do you extend answers?
So I think a lot of it's about the culture that you set in the classroom. So if you're really centering oracy in the classroom, making sure that you're creating loads of extended opportunities for children to engage in, you know, discussion, debate, and then I guess just building really language-rich classrooms where you're, you know, children come in after the weekend, you're asking them what they did, you're feeding them new language, you're giving them opportunities to kind of try out and explore that new language through talk.
Well, let's listen to Tia. Now, she's experienced being taught oracy at school, so let's have a listen to her and see what she made of those sessions.
My name is Tia, and I went to a school that taught oracy. One lesson I remember was in Year 10 English. We were given a photo of a busy high street and asked to imagine the story behind it. After finishing that assignment, instead of just moving on, we talked about it and verbally mind-mapped the scene as a class. We described our senses, what we could see, what we might hear. We practiced zooming in and out on the people in the picture. Who were they? Where were they going? Why were they there? Listening to everyone else's ideas helped me realize that there isn't just one way to view the world. Many stories could exist in a single moment. Oracy changed me. It gave me permission to think creatively, question assumptions, and build on other people's perspectives. Talking it through helped me understand where my own thinking and writing could go further. Learning in that way helped me develop the confidence to explore ideas deeply and express them clearly. Those skills stayed with me ever since. I'm now studying social science, and that journey has recently led to an offer to study PBS at the University of Cambridge.
We just heard there from Tia that she's going to use the university. She talked about she's going to study PBS at Cambridge, and the PBS is psychology and behaviour science. So what about the world of work?
So I guess there's something instinctive, isn't there, that we know that oracy skills are really important in the world of work. They're important to kind of get jobs. We know you need oracy skills to perform well at interview, but also when you have a job, they're important. Most jobs involve talking to people, and I think in the age of AI, they're even more important. So we often talk about these human skills like oracy, which are going to be the most difficult to automate and which will have the kind of the greatest currency in this AI-driven world that we're soon to be living in.
And all the soft skills to do with, well, I don't know, being nice, cooperating, and not being somebody horrible. I mean, that's pretty important as well, isn't it?
Yeah, we often talk about the link between oracy and well-being as well, that talk is at the heart of how we kind of build and sustain relationships, and that's important, obviously, in the workplace, but also it's just a really important skill to have in life.
Just a bit.
Yeah.
Now, we should say that there are some people who think that this isn't really appropriate, or even I've heard that it's actually a waste of valuable school time. Now, the argument goes, I think, that our job in schools, people like you and sometimes me, is to impart knowledge, the way they put it, as fast and as efficiently as possible. And what's going to happen then is that's going to free up children's minds, this is the argument I've heard, so that they can think using the knowledge that's been imparted to them. That's the theory. So they say there isn't time for this chat. They sometimes diminish it like that. And what's more, it's often inconsequential or plain wrong. Someone might pick up, for example, that those children responding to Langston Hughes's poem, the one that I gave them, they were going on about, you know, what it was like being a teenager and having to eat fish fingers, which has nothing to do with the poem, they might say. I might argue that that's actually the emotional feeling is the same. But anyway, they say this isn't time. And what happens, they also say, is that the lowest achievers get squashed out in these oracy situations because the more able students dominate. I have heard that argument. So they say this approach fails the least able students. What would you say to that?
Well, I would say that the evidence doesn't really support that view. So there's a lot of quite robust research which shows that those sort of dialogic, talk-rich approaches to teaching that you were talking about earlier really do improve attainment, and that that's particularly pronounced for children who are eligible for free school meals, so those kind of economically disadvantaged students. And that's not what I hear from teachers either. So when I talk to teachers who are focusing on oracy in their classrooms, they often tell me that a focus on oracy actually helps students who might otherwise struggle to access the curriculum, particularly through writing. You know, giving them the chance to talk about their learning actually kind of opens up the curriculum to them. And I guess in reality, you can't just transfer what the teacher knows into the student's head. You know, students don't just absorb knowledge, they need to process that information, and talk is a really effective way of doing that.
Let me go back to when I was at school. That was in the 1950s, primary school anyway. Classroom full of 48 children. And talk went like this. If you had something to say, you had to put your hand up. You said it one-to-one to the teacher. The teacher spoke to you. Or you waited for the teacher to ask a question, point at you, and you had to try and answer. That was about the limit. Anything else was naughty, actually. What do you think about that? As a way of learning. Look at me, I'm a success, he said boastfully. I came through that system. What would you think was wrong with that?
I wouldn't say there's anything wrong with that. I think it's about, we often talk about teachers' repertoire, so being able to use different approaches at different moments within a lesson. So sometimes it might be that the most effective thing that a teacher can do is to explain something really clearly, so do that sort of teacher exposition that you're sort of describing there. Sometimes it might be, you know, asking questions, listing student responses. Other times it might be like opening up the floor for discussion as a classroom. And I think what teachers do really well is kind of judiciously deciding which of those methods is appropriate when.
So you're not talking about denying the teacher the role of being the knowledgeable other, the knowledgeable person in the room. You're saying that you use the word repertoire, that in a classroom a teacher would sometimes...